Hello, my name is Colin Daniels. I'm the Working Age and Young People Service Manager for the Macular Society. Now, as you might know, the Macular Society hosts two live webinars each month focusing on all aspects of living with macular disease. We speak to leading experts, clinicians, and researchers about the latest in macular disease. The first of the webinars focuses very much on age-related macular degeneration, and the second on areas for people of a working age and a bit younger. Now, we understand that not everyone has the opportunity to watch our webinars, so we have decided to turn some of the content into podcasts. The podcasts will be available on all good podcast platforms. So here we go. We're very fortunate. We've got a really good team. And actually, it's one of these sessions where I can just do the introductions and sort of I can watch the world go by, really, and learn as much as you guys. I'm going to try and say this, which is punctate inner choroidopathy. If you can mark me on that later, better known as PIC. So tonight we have Alistair Dennister from Queen's Hospital in Birmingham, who are going to give us a really good update on everything that they're doing and latest around PIC. So I don't know, Alistair, very nice. Thank you for joining us this evening. Very grateful. And it's over to you.
Colin, thank you very much. We're really honoured to be joining this evening and looking forward to a good discussion. We hope that will be helpful. That's the aim. But I look forward to sharing the team's expertise and stories. So we're going to start with Alison. So I met Alison for the first time in 2012. Alison, could you tell us your story, please?
My name's Alison. I'm 50 years old. I'm a mum of three. And my journey started 25 years ago, so when I was quite young, not long married, and I noticed disturbances in my vision, grey spots, wavy lines when you look at the math, if you look at math paper that's got all squares in it, lots of wavy lines. So I went to an optician who panicked and sent me straight to a hospital. And at that time, I don't think much was particularly known about PIC. And there weren't any effective treatments available. So after two operations that didn't work, the sight or most of the central sight in the right eye was lost and has been lost. You can't retrieve. So I had one really good, perfect CNI, and I went along with life, had my children. And when I had my twins, about a year after, so they were a year old, I noticed the symptoms appear again, the grey spots in the vision, spinning lights, wavy lines, and I panicked. I knew it was happening again. I didn't quite know what was happening, but I knew something was happening again. My route to diagnosis was a little challenging because we've picked patients, as well as I guess some of you, when you present at hospital, when you're given an eye chart, you can pick out black writing on a white background because you're looking around the disturbances you have in your vision. And so I was told, no, you're fine, go away. But I wasn't. So I looked for other routes to get my diagnosis confirmed. And I met the amazing Maria Salinas, who then tested me and said, look, I think you have PIC. And I have an amazing consultant at the QE who is best suited to treat you. So then I felt relieved I'd got a diagnosis. And then as soon as I found Mr. Denniston, I knew that I was in safe hands and we formulated a treatment plan together. And that's the key thing I found in my treatment, is that it's not a one-sided discussion. We talk together for my treatment and where we're gonna go. And this then became a very difficult few years, very, very difficult. By this point, sight had deteriorated. I couldn't drive, I couldn't read, I couldn't see my children's faces to care for them how I wanted to. I was very insular in my environment. I wasn't confident to go out. I couldn't take them to groups. Financially, I wasn't working, and I had a lot of support, but it was family support. So the ripple effect was quite wide. And what was happening was my flares or reactivation of my PIC was happening very speedily. So my treatment was trisimolone, which I think would last about 6 weeks, and then my vision would go. And we repeated that. And then we moved to Ozurdex, which probably gave me another 8 weeks, an additional 2 weeks, and then my vision would go. So it was a cycle of vision, no vision, vision, no vision. And then, of course, with every wonderful treatment, there are always side effects. So this gave me extremely high pressure, in the only eye I could see out of. So I had this wonderful tag team between City Hospital and the QE, where Mr. Denniston would fix my PIC, Mr. Pandy would fix my raised pressure. So it ended up with Mr. Denniston apologising to Mr. Pandy, I'm undoing your work with Alison, can you fix that? And then we came to another crisis point where my pressure was at 60. So I ended up having a trabeculectomy, and that kind of resolved that issue. But I was in a situation where I literally lived at the two hospitals. Clinic visits were every week, if not twice a week, for a long period of time. And then an amazing thing happened. Mr. Denniston put me forward for an Iluvium implant, which has really changed my life beyond my wildest dreams from where I was. It's basically the same, similar to an Ozurdex, where it's an implant into the eye that slow releases the medication over a long period of time. And it's not as invasive to cause other issues because it's a slow release. And I'm coming up 3.5 years now of no further treatment, which means it's Iluvium. It's an Iluvium implant, which is remarkable. So I've gone from, you know, not working to working. I've gone from not being able to read. I can drive. I can have all the experiences with my family and friends that I was, you know, shying away from before. And it's life back to normal, which for a mom with children and it's just amazing. You know, being able to give a bedtime story to my children at night is something I'll never ever take for granted. One thing that we were able to do as part of the team was this treatment wasn't available for everybody with different eye diseases, and I was put forward by a charity, Olivia's Vision, to go forward to NICE to get this approved, which we were able to do. And I think that, for me, has been a very positive experience, because now people with PIC and other diseases now have that additional treatment in reserve for when they need it.
Thanks, Alison. I think one of the things I would just say is that everybody's experience of PIC will be different. And Alison's story, Alison experienced many, many different treatments before we had the breakthrough with the Iluvium. So I guess one of the things to take away is not Iluvium's the answer for everybody. But I think one of the things I would definitely carry from that is that, as Alison said, working out treatment was something we did together. You know, hopefully I brought some expertise to that conversation, but somebody who has the lived experience of their condition knows things that I will never know, and will know the kind of impact that a particular treatment and the kind of pros and cons of it is going to make in their life. And it was a long, challenging period, as Alison's mentioned there. So
no, it wasn't a quick process. I tried to keep it to a time scale. One thing that you've said there, Alistair, and I don't want to take up too much time, the relief that somebody would listen and we would talk through what was happening and I could give you information and you listen to me was so reassuring for me, because sometimes there were decisions that were quite tough. And we had to sort of say, no, Alison, you need to wait and we need to do the right process. But because we've spoken about it, and, you know, I knew that I could trust that we were doing this together and it was going to be the right thing for me.
And Alison, it's probably worth pointing out as well that for you it was a sort of combination of treatments, in that you were also having the tablet immunosuppression as well. But yes. That hadn't been enough to control it without these pop-up steroid injections. So, Alison, we'll come back to you, because when we come to the questions, and there's a couple of comments many people saying thank you for sharing. Yeah, and I say again, you know, you and I have talked about this in many different forums together, but it's very precious that you're happy to share your story. So we do thank you for that. So I'm going to ask Barlini, you're a consultant, my consultant colleague. So we do the UBS Connects together at Queen Elizabeth Hospital, Birmingham. Well, you do all the work and I drink coffee, and that works very well. So I'd like to invite you to tell us about PIC now and from the medical perspective as well.
Thank you, Alistair. And thank you, Alison, for your side of the story. It's really nice to hear from you and about your experience, especially about the symptoms that you had, you know, because we've only as clinicians read about it in the books. So it's really nice to learn from you. Thank you. So this is just a really brief introduction to PIC. It's not entirely a sort of update as such, but this is kind of what we do in clinic and a brief introduction. So PIC was first described, or punctate inner choroidopathy was first described by Watsky and colleagues in 1984. And they described it in a series of 10 patients who all happened to be short-sighted. And in this case series, they found that about 8 out of 10 of these patients had PIC in both eyes, and 6 of them developed some of the complications that we see with PIC. So what is PIC? PIC is essentially idiopathic, which basically means we don't know what causes the inflammation exactly, but it's a chronic inflammatory disorder that affects the choriocapillaris layer. And what causes PIC is basically this inflammation in the chorioretinitis causes reduced blood flow, which then causes lack of blood supply to the outer retina, which breaks down and forms these PIC lesions, which have been described by Professor Denniston as like little volcanoes, which is a nice description for them because that's how they look when we do the imaging. So who gets PIC? In the literature, most of these patients seem to be 85% happen to be short-sighted, with an average spherical equivalent, which basically means the prescription power in the lenses of -4 to -7, but the range could be more. Majority of the studies seem to be in people with white skin tones, and the more common in females, and comparison between China, the United States, and the UK show that somewhere between 70 to 90% of cases with PIC happen to be females. The incidence has been shown to be around 5.6 per 100,000 per year. And in a study by Nick Jones and colleagues in Manchester, they found that nearly 3% of the uveitis clinic workload was due to PIC. Another study has shown about 26% of patients may have a family history of other autoimmune diseases. So what symptoms are noted with PIC? So Alison mentioned seeing a gray spot and wavy lines, and often this is what people describe. And in the literature out there, and what we hear from patients is that they may describe blind spots, and that seems to be seen in nearly 91% of cases. Patients describe blurred or reduced vision or darkening of vision in nearly 86%, shimmering or flashing lights, floaters, photophobia or light sensitivity, and distorted vision or metamorphopsia. And a smaller percentage also describes some peripheral field or visual field changes. So what signs do we find? We may see these yellow-gray lesions that are at the level of the deeper retina between the retinal pigment epithelium and the choroid, which is the blood supply to the retina. And they see these small breaks or small retinal detachments within the neurosensory retina. Other signs that we see with PIC is that it's documented that nearly 70% of patients with PIC develop choroidal neovessels growing, and they form these choroidal neovascular membranes. And we can do imaging techniques which are non-invasive to look for this in the clinic. What tests do we do to diagnose and monitor PIC? So these are some typical images you might see when you attend clinic. So this is an ultra-wide field retinal image, and we can see the retina in color as well as autofluorescence, and this helps us to assess whether the disease might be active or inactive. Other imaging tests include optical coherence tomography or OCT. And here you can see some characteristic mini volcano type lesions, which are showing a thickening of the choroidal layer and a break in the basement membrane and with these peaks forming into the neurosensory retina. If new vessels grow into these areas, you can then get leakage as well, and you might see fluid and swelling of the retina. Other tests we do, as I mentioned earlier, are OCT angiography. It's a really useful tool for us in clinic because it allows us in a non-invasive way to document new vessel growth. So how do we treat PIC? We have to treat the two pathogenic mechanisms in PIC. One is the underlying cause, which is the inflammation, and the other is the complications associated with PIC, which include the choroidal neovascular membranes. So the inflammation, as Alison mentioned, can be treated with periocular steroid or triamcinolone, as Alison mentioned, which can last a much shorter time. And it's a useful way to check pressure response in patients. So it might be some of the first things we would do. And then following that, we might try a shorter term intravitreal implant, such as dexamethasone 0.7 milligrams, which is otherwise known as Ozudex, or fluocinolone acetate, which is a 0.19 milligram implant, which is called Illuvien. And this can last up to 3 years or more. Aside from the local therapy, we can also consider systemic treatments, which can be in the form of oral corticosteroids, but we don't like to, because of the long list of side effects associated with systemic corticosteroid use, we don't like to use them for too long. So we often, if required, would screen patients for other immunomodulatory treatments, and there's a list there. The ones used more commonly are mycophenolate. There's also another agent that is required in some patients who have refractory disease or increased flares in the form of biologics, such as anti-TNF blockers, such as adalimumab. And finally, just to mention that if we see active CNV, we may have to, in addition to the treatment of inflammation, treat the new vessel growth with intravitreal injections of an anti-VEGF agent. And currently we use either Avastin or Eylea or Lucentis in clinic. In terms of prognosis, vision can be maintained quite well if we treat early and aggressively. So without the complication of new vessels or fibrosis, we can get pretty good vision. And as Alison has given an example, her vision is excellent in that eye that's been treated. In cases where, despite treatment, scarring happens, then the visual prognosis may be more guarded. And as I mentioned, and Professor Dennison mentioned also, that in cases where local therapy alone is not enough, we may have to give more than one form of treatment, both systemic as well as local therapy.
Thanks, Marlene. That's a great overview. Now, I want to introduce Rob Carmichael. Is our clinical nurse specialist in the PIC clinic. And there was a time when patients coming to our clinic wanted to see me. In fact, these days, they only care about seeing Rob. So Rob, why is that? What's your role in clinic?
I think I make a better cup of tea than you do, Alistair. I think that's the key thing. My role is quite niche. And essentially, I think what I do in terms of practical terms is to offer a bridge between the patient and the clinical team so that we can work collaboratively together in terms of their care. But more importantly, there are certain things that I want to do specifically for the patient, and that is essentially to educate them, to support them, and empower them in light and in response to this, you know, sometimes quite rotten disease that they have ended up acquiring. Okay, so there are certain things that I need to be aware of and I need to be attuned to. And I have really clever people like you, Alistair and Bellini, that are very, very good expert, in fact, at identifying what the problem is, diagnosing what that problem is, you know, advising on treatments and where we move forward medically. But I think sometimes with issues such as this, there's a deficit in knowledge and care with the holistic aspect, the more pastoral wraparound care for these patients that have been given a diagnosis that they've hitherto unheard of, never heard of it. It doesn't help that, sadly, a number of the patients that I know that we see have had various issues in the past where they've been told it's because you're short-sighted, so this is why you have this particular type of macular degeneration, for example. Whereas the PIC itself, the inflammatory process involved in PIC isn't being picked up, so there's an element of misdiagnosis. People are getting treated over and over again, but the actual driver of that isn't necessarily being addressed. So by the time they come to us, a lot of our patients have been through the mill, and there's a lot to kind of sort out and help them out with. As well as coming to the diagnosis, it's what we're going to do with the patient thereafter. So I think the first thing to say really is that we, as a team, we make the observation that PIC is in and of itself, it's a process. It doesn't think, it doesn't care. It just does what it does. And because of that, we know that it does not respect the fact that you've got friends and family and a career to attend to. It doesn't matter that you can, you know, if you play music, you're struggling to see your sheet music, or if you're an artist, your canvas isn't as clear as it was. We know that, that if it's progressive and it's not picked up in an early period of time, as Barlini was saying, but, you know, the outcomes are better the earlier it's picked up. If it's left longer, then things do get a little trickier for some patients. So the problem there is that you've lived with all these problems up to and including the diagnosis. You're then given the diagnosis and then you're told these are the treatments that are available to you, and you've got all this stuff swirling around. The number of patients that I've seen that have been really, really brave and resolute and have fought tough and nail not to define themselves as being a patient or being defined by their PIC is amazing. But that's a really difficult thing to do. And I think that's really my key role. And I can tell you a little bit about the practical side of things that I do, if, you know, a little bit later when we're talking about the question, when the questions are being asked and so on and so forth. But for me, as a member of the team, what I want to do is I want to help the patient navigate this new, weird and unsettling terrain that they're in. I want them to be in a position where they feel empowered and enabled to lead the life that they want to still pursue their dreams, their ambitions, even if that ambition is just sitting down and watching Netflix of a Saturday night. Whatever that patient wants, that's what I want to try and give them the tools and the equipment to be able to do that without feeling that they're beholden to their diagnosis. So that arguably is the fluffy part of what I do, the pop psychology shells at your local Waterstones. But it's important and it's integral, and that's supported by a lot of clinical knowledge and expertise that I've picked up from you, from Bellini, and just working with you in this particular clinic for about, oh, almost about 10 years now, I think. So to give patients with PIC and those that are associated with PIC a broader idea in terms of what I do, firstly, I'm a registered nurse, of course. I have a lot of a degree in ophthalmology, and I've got a post-qualification certificate to say that I'm clever-ish with eyes, okay? And my particular area of specialist interest is in uveitis, involving the back of the eye primarily. And they're the kind of like technical tools that allow you to contribute to the team in a more practical and pragmatic way. So for example, I'm usually the first port of call for any patient. Any patient we have that falls onto our radar, they are given my telephone number. And the reason for that is that because I'm not a gatekeeper as such, but I'm probably better equipped than anybody else in our department outside of the uveitis team to assess, triage, and identify and stratify risk for that particular patient. So I can reassure if reassurance is what is needed. But if there's anything that's said to me that makes me worried, if there's something that's suggested of these new blood vessels that are starting to percolate away at the back of the eye, or there's maybe that inflammation that's just grumbling away, then my level of sensitivity and threshold for that is actually much, much higher than it would be at, say, a general ophthalmology unit. If you're complaining of floaters, you know what, I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to want to see you and do scans. Because there's other things to consider involving the mechanics of the eye, and that's not really relevant for now, but there are certain things that we want to exclude before we actually get on to, you know, if there's an actual problem at that time. So I offer hopefully more rapid access to the medical team, okay? And I can only do that with the experience and knowledge that I have and working with the team that I've got. So I can, fortunately, I'm in a position where I can read scans in a fashion so I can identify if there's problems burgeoning, and again, flag up and escalate to yourself, Alistair, and Bellini. But then there's the question as to, in terms of what we do. Now, some patients, this is entirely new to them. So we're talking about maybe giving them steroid, either orally or into the eye. They may have gone down this route several times, like Alison did when she first started, and we start introducing systemic therapies. And so another kind of feather in my cap for this is that I look after all the patients who are on these weird and sometimes quite unnerving and unsettling treatments. We're told we can do something for this for you, but there's no, you know, there are certain risks involved with these medications that we give you. So I would be tasked with counselling the patient appropriately to ensure that they know full well what it is that we're prescribing for them and why we would suggest that. But I would also look at the broader picture. There may be medications that we would want to pursue and start that may not be appropriate for certain patients. If, for example, they, you know, newly married, looking at starting a family, there are certain medications that we have to exclude. And then we've got to consider other treatment options. And sometimes, much as we're lucky to have such wonderfully open lines of communication with our medical team and our nursing team and our patients, and I think we're very fortunate there, sometimes those conversations can be a little bit trickier, or the question in the consultation room is quite often forgot. And it's not until afterwards that the patient will turn and go, oh, crikey, I didn't think that, need to ask. So as well as offering counselling and support, that's what I mean about having to be the bridge between the patient and our team. So I'm trying to advocate, I try to support, I try to offer wraparound pastoral care. I appreciate that what I'm saying is arguably a bit sketchy, but it's just because I do so much of the intangibles, the things that you can't record, you can't capture on a scan, to try and make our life as best as possible for our patients. Again, my main concern is to advocate, support, educate, and then allow our patients to lead the lives that they want to lead. And, you know, if we can even get them to sit down and watch Netflix quite happily, if that's all that they want to do, but if they're happy doing that and we achieve that, then I think, you know, we've done well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just to say, we're very privileged to have a fantastic team. But I think one of the things is I wouldn't want people to come away with the feeling that we've got all the answers, because we really haven't. I mean, Alison's kind enough to say great care she's had with us, but, you know, we're learning too. And, you know, and this was, you know, as Alison said, it was a long, hard road as we were juggling different treatments and trying to find what worked for her. And so we recognize that, you know, this is not a kind of, oh, come to our clinic and it'll all be solved. It really isn't. It isn't like that. But we're really happy to be here to sort of share the learning we've made over the years and hopefully answer questions and hopefully be useful. So we're going to move into the sort of discussion and questions. And one of the questions that came in ahead of time was from Amiko, a number of questions, but one of them was around research and being aware that this is a rare condition. But if we look internationally, is there an opportunity to sort of connect people and to try and understand a bit more about that? So at short notice, I asked Dr. Kale, who's joined us, because actually he's just about to start some research into the group of conditions of which PIC is a very, very key part. Addy, do you want to just give us 2 minute summary on the research you're doing and what you hope to do?
Hello, everyone. My name's Addy. Okay, so just a couple of minutes of your time, if that's okay. Thanks very much, Alistair, for the introduction. So on the research side of things, I've had the pleasure of planning a research project program of work with Alistair and team, looking at sight-threatening inflammation at the back of the eye. So as you've heard from Dr. Bellini and Rob as well, who have very nicely described how uveitis, including PIC, can affect the back of the eye, including the retina and the choroid, which are the key structures responsible for sight. We at the moment, there's a number of different treatments for inflammation in terms of PIC and other types of uveitis, as you've heard already. And the inflammation in these layers at the back of the eye, although we have all of these various wonderful treatments, the inflammation is actually very difficult to firstly detect and monitor, which means that although we have these treatments, it can be difficult to decide on when to start treatment, when to change a treatment, and when to actually stop treating. And sometimes we do end up over-treating. So we're looking at some research. Firstly, we're going to focus on the various different imaging tests and diagnostic tests that we have to hand and how they relate with functional markers that are picked up in clinic, but also in the very important discussions that you have with doctors and also the functional visual questionnaires and kind of how it affects your day-to-day life. The second part is looking at particularly how we use all of this information to inform our treatment decisions. And this would basically be us looking at discussions. This would be through discussions with not only clinical experts, but also patients of the allied healthcare professionals and various, a broad variety of stakeholders, including carers and other device innovators. And we would be looking at how it's done at the moment, how do we identify these inflammatory spots, what the best way to assess them would be, how this should be done in the future in terms of what the priorities for research and development should be. The last part, looking at automating this lesion tracking, but we would look at automating the progression of the lesions and tracking that versus measures of visual functions and patient-reported outcome measures that would be picked up via questionnaires, kind of tracking the lesions. This is what we're working on at the moment. You can see the lesions at the top growing in size, and we would essentially want to track the total area. And not only does that tell us the area affected at the back of the eye, but it also gives us a very nice indicator of when someone's having a flare-up, which we can see is the expansion rate. So essentially, this program of work, as I said, split into the three parts, helps us to try and identify how best to actually measure this inflammation and these inflammatory spots at the back of the eye in order to inform our treatment decisions. Thanks for that. Whistle stop tour, there we go. And if you have any questions, then please feel free.
So thank you, Adi. And Emiko, you asked how could people get involved? Well, we're still at relatively early stages for this particular project. It does follow up quite a big program of research in this area. One of the ways we can advertise this and let people get involved is actually, if Colin's happy, we can send him details to put up on the Macular Society when we're ready to invite people to get involved. We're not quite there yet, so it'll probably still be a couple of months before we formally start. Right, thank you, Adi. I think that one of the reasons why this particular area of research within PIC has been important to us is that we've seen consistently this issue that the challenges of detecting and monitoring the condition. And this is something that Alison's been very involved with as we've developed the clinic, is we've really systematically done the scans so that by doing exactly the same set of scans at every single visit, we have learned together what's significant and what isn't. So Alison would text my secretary, the lovely Jackie, and say, I've lost the 5 on my mobile phone because actually that little patch, that tiny blind spot, she would detect because that bit of the mobile phone was missing. And then she'd come in, and she's not alone in this, you know, other patients in our clinic would do the same. And we'd do the scans and we'd look really carefully, and they might look initially fairly normal. And then we'd do the direct comparison and we'd see, oh, okay, there is actually a new spot just growing there. Now, in the old days, before we had OCT scans, we wouldn't have been able to detect that at all. And some of you who perhaps had the condition for longer will have had the incredibly upsetting experience of turning up the clinic, knowing something was wrong, and being told, no, there's nothing to see. And that's not doctors being mean and nasty or lazy. It's just we couldn't see anything. And we also didn't have very good tools for treatment. One of the things the scans has really helped us is actually being able to detect something. But we see our role in the clinic is to share that learning, because we are aware that some of the techniques we used are not completely widely adopted. And Adi's program of work is about understanding and defining what best practice should be in the clinic for everybody's sake, and doing that together. So Adi, thank you. Right, I'm going to dish out some questions to people, and I'm working backwards. So, Helen, this tracking system sounds great, as the challenge is getting diagnosed and treat for many of us. So that's absolutely true. Question for Colin, what platform is the best way to follow the Macular Society?
Well, The best way really is for working age people. You can join the Working Age and Young People's Facebook group. And also our website is the best resource. Anything or new research, news articles around macular disease of any type, shape or description, get posted onto there. And I always recommend signing up to our newsletter, because that comes out once a month with all the latest information.
That's brilliant, Colin. Thank you. And I can strongly recommend, I think if you go on the website, it automatically invites you to sign up for the newsletter. And it's very good. So thanks, Colin. And thank you, Geraldine. You said that you'd be happy to advertise for participants when you're ready through the Macular Society. That's really appreciated. Jody asks, can people with PIC have laser eye surgery for short-sightedness? Barlini, do you want to answer that one?
Thank you. I think refractive surgery is possible, but like any surgery in the eye, there's a risk of increased inflammation. So we have to kind of counteract that with possibly considering steroid cover for the short term, pre, intraoperatively and postoperatively. So I wouldn't say that it's something that you should rule out, but just take into consideration that it might increase the inflammation in the eye.
Thanks, Barlini. I mean, I think it's certainly true that many people who come to our clinic have had refractive surgery for short-sightedness previously, you know, after many, many years before. And it's obviously important for people to also realise that whilst refractive surgery might correct the short-sightedness, it's not going to do anything to help the PIC. It's not, as Barlini says, it's not a complete rule out, but it's not something I'd rush into in this context. There's somebody points out that in Adi, for you, that in terms of inviting people to participate in the study, the PIC Facebook group would be another route as well. Jody asks about academic papers. I'll see if there's, we did quite a big academic review summarizing a lot of what Barlini presented earlier. The other thing is on the Macular Society website, there are some materials, but those are a bit more kind of summary and they don't have all the details of the different studies. Is it possible to have PIC in just one eye, or is it always both eyes? Barlini, do you want to answer that one?
The exact percentages don't come to mind, but you know, it can definitely be asymmetrical disease and can be in both eyes. It can present initially in one eye, but then later on can develop in the second as well. So it's not a unilateral disease by any means.
Thank you. To say on that, actually, so Katriona has just shared a helpful experience. She says, I've only got it in one eye, and that was diagnosed 22 years ago. So it's definitely true that we haven't looked after a number of people who've, you know, a bit like your story, Katriona, it's always and, you know, ever shall be one eye. Somebody else somewhere in the chat also asked about, you know, can you ever say, oh, well, it's burnt out now, or it's not going to flare again. Is there a time, you know, 10 years, 20 years, etc.? I'm going to sit on the fence with that one a bit, because I mean, for all of us, you know, there will always be a last flare, but you kind of never know when it's going to be. So that's the frustrating thing. But I think it's true that the longer the gap, lower the chance of it flaring up again. So a long period without a flare is obviously very, very reassuring. But you know, we don't have a biological test for saying, yeah, it's definitely finished. About a million people, slight exaggeration, have asked about hormonal effects. So I don't know who to turn to for that one. So I'm happy to give some half an answer. Alison, what's your thought on that one?
So obviously I've given this a lot of thought. So I had my first occurrence before I had my first child, and then I had period of stability. So I'm happy to share this, but the twins were IVF, so there was a lot of hormonal manipulation going on, and I didn't flare at that time going through all that treatment. I flared, obviously the flares came back when they were a year old. I think it's going to be really, really hard to prove that. I think when you have a disease like this, you search for triggers, you search for reasons. If, you know, what can I do? I think there is an element of that because I think it's predominantly a female-based disease, not exclusively, but predominantly, so that, you know, women tend to have a lot more hormonal changes than men. I'm going to sit on the fence. I'm not convinced. No, I'm not convinced.
Thanks, Alison. I'm going to sit on the fence too on this one. And the normal way that academics sit on the fence is say further research should be done. And I mean, I guess my view is that there must be a hormonal link, actually, in the sense that, you know, who gets this condition? Well, it is 90% women, and it is between the kind of the sort of the working ages, as they say. But it does seem to, the kind of incidence does drop off very significantly after menopause. And there are a very significant number of people who come to our clinic who do draw a hormonal link. But as Alison says, that's a really tough one for us to definitely prove. A similarly tough one is the question of, is it linked to stress? Now, we know that the stress also causes hormonal changes. We also know that stress is involved in changes in your immune system. So there's plenty of biological reasons why it should be connected to stress. And we also have many patients who would come to the clinic and say, oh, well, I'm not surprised it's flaring up at the moment. You know, life's been really tough. But again, because we all are subject to so many spikes of stress, and as humans, we tend to try and join the dots, which is one of our strengths as humans, but it's also one of our weaknesses. Sometimes we join dots that actually are just random. I think it's a hard one to know. So if I come off the fence, I think there is a link to hormones and I think there is a link to stress, but I also don't think it's as really simple. I think it's, these things are parts of a number of factors, such as your genetic background, which we know is a factor, and so on. There is probably, somebody asked about, do I think Epstein-Barr virus is related? So I think what we know about autoimmune conditions, oh, and that was another question. So yes, I do believe it's an autoimmune condition. Again, evidence is kind of weaker than some other conditions, but we know that there is an immune component here. So I think you can very legitimately label it as an autoimmune condition. But we know that in that group of conditions, there's often a genetic predisposition to have an exaggerated immune response. And then something, often unknown, stimulates or tickles the immune system, and the immune system then overreacts. And what that something is, we don't often identify, but many people with these and similar conditions will say, actually, I had a really bad episode of flu. It may not have been actually the influenza virus, but it's a viral illness, which seems to have been that trigger. Other people might point to a different trigger, but there's no reason why for one person, you know, the Epstein-Barr virus might have been that trigger, but for somebody else, it might be something else again. But thank you, Alison. Oh, there's a few people who've asked about scarring. Now that's a tricky one, and I think that's important for us to spend a bit of time on. I'm actually going to go a step back, just because I know we've covered a lot today. And I'm going to draw back to what Barlini said. And she drew this very clear distinction, and this is really important, okay, between the inflammation that's caused by PIC and the problems that might arise downstream from that inflammation. And I know Barlini went over it, but I'm just going to go over it again, because this is really important, because it's what should inform the treatment decisions that you and your consultants and team make. So the underlying process with PIC is this inflammation at the back of the eye, between the retina and the choroid, caused by the immune system getting a bit overexcited. And that's what causes these inflammatory spots or little volcanoes. They can build and they can just disappear of their own accord. But most often these days, as soon as we spot them, we would jump in and treat them by trying to dampen down the immune system. And as we've already discussed, that might be with tablet type immunosuppressants, whether steroids or some of these other agents, or it might be by putting steroid into the eye. So Ozurdex, we mentioned, and Iluvien. But all those treatments are about calming down the immune system around the eye and in the eye and getting those pick spots to just fade away, causing as little damage as possible. The trouble is, or the second trouble is, one is we need to control the inflammation. But what can sometimes happen is if you've had those little inflammatory spots, you've got little weak patches at the back of the eye. And that's what sometimes weeks, months, even years later, those little weak areas mean that the vascular supply that underlies it, the choroid, can sometimes sense that area of weakness. And it's trying to sort of settle it down and heal it. But by going into that area, it starts to cause trouble. And that's what we call choroidal neovascular membranes. And this is a bit similar to what happens, or very similar actually to what happens in that condition, macular degeneration, which typically affects much older people than people who get PIC. Because in macular degeneration, just the getting older causes these little areas of weakness into which blood vessels can grow. But with people with PIC, it's because of the inflammation causing weakness, which then allows those blood vessels to grow. And it's when you have those neovascular membranes that we use this second group of drugs called anti-VEGF therapies, things like Lucentis and Eylea and so on. So we've got two different processes, the underlying process is inflammation, but often what is causing people trouble and is having more treatment is the abnormal blood vessels. Now, the abnormal blood vessels, particularly, or the inflammation itself, either of those processes can go on to give a third trouble, which is the scarring. Now, the scarring, we're not very good at treating. I mean, you know that from if you have a cut on the arm or something, and, you know, it's a healing process, which is trying to calm down the trouble, but it does leave a scar. It doesn't disappear. There is a lot of research going into this, not just for PIC, but for other retinal conditions, because we don't have good ways of reversing it. And for many people, and probably many people on this call, it is the scarring that has caused the most damage, and that we don't have treatments that can melt that away yet. I stress that because it doesn't, you know, if your doctor that you're seeing says, actually, we don't have any treatment for the retinal scarring, that is sadly correct at this stage. But the only hope I can offer in that space is this is an area of intense research. And I really do believe that we will see treatments that can undo some, if not all, of that process. But it's going, you know, we are talking years off still, and it is really challenging. So at the moment, the thing that we need to prioritize is actually treating the acute stage, the reversible bits, so that the inflammatory spots, the choroidal neovascular membranes. So sorry, everybody, I know I spent a long time on that, but there's quite a few questions around that, and I wanted to do justice to it.
Was there any other group of questions there that you feel needs addressing?
No, there's no link between PIC and contact lenses.
Yeah.
So I think that's it from me. I'll give the last word to Alison.
So the one thing I want to say is that the care I receive is excellent. And when I heard Rob, I'm sorry I missed you specifically out of the loop. You do feel completely cared for. It's a very holistic environment to go in. And when you're frightened and you're scared and you don't know what's going on, yes, you have the treatment, but the rest of it is amazing when you're most vulnerable. In fact, I would say everybody that I see at the QE treat me more as a friend than a patient, and for that I will be forever grateful. And the other thing is that this experience has given me hope from, you know, the start of the journey to the end of the journey, and we still don't know what life will throw at us. I've come away with hope and knowing that the team are working so hard for his patients. I'm just so privileged to have them behind me.
Alison, that's an amazing way to finish this session. So I want to start off by saying thank you very much for sharing your story. It's been inspirational. I think you speak very differently about your journey And I think that gives hope to lots of people. So thanks very much. Alistair, Bellini, Rob, and last minute Addy, as I think you shall now be known. Thanks ever so much for joining us as well. I've learned so much. It's such a rarely discussed condition. So thank you for giving your time to answer questions and talk so openly about this condition. It's amazing. It would be remiss of me to say at this point, not to mention that we do have the Macular Society has a research participation database. So you can always sign up for that. So Geraldine quite often gets, we get by different research organisations around the world looking for participants. You know, they look for specific things, but if you're on the database, your toes in the water, so to speak. Again, finally, just to say thank you to Alistair, Bellini, Rob, Addy, and also you, Alison. And I hope you found this session useful. So thank you very much, and goodbye.